and certainly aren't going to be tested about what we're doing. Right? And so what I'd like to do is share with you some of what I've been thinking about lately, and that came out in this book called The Menorah, the Bible to, from the Bible to Modern Israel, that thankfully Harvard University Press managed to time the publication of the book to Hanukkah. The only reason they did that was because Hanukkah was late this year. And they had no idea what they were doing. It's what they call hashkacha pratit in the English language. And so that's been very nice. What we're going to do, we have the paper? Don't look at it. Okay. Could I have one? Because if I don't have one, I can't teach it. What we're going to do is take a look at some images. Oh, look how short it came out. Take a look at some images that I was fortunate enough to present at the Metropolitan Museum of Art a couple weeks ago, where they did a book event around this thing, which was pretty cool. And what was it's been most nice about it, frankly, is that my YU students have been in on this project since the day of before I decided to do it. And so reading the articles as I wrote them, and then reading the manuscripts as I wrote it, and then participating in my Coursera course, which is the Arch of Titus and the Menorah, which is a free course that's YU put on Coursera, which is one of the places that the top 30 or 40 universities in America highlight what they do and the scholars that work in their institutions, and happily YU included my work as part of that. And so that's free, and you can go do that. So the students have been through that, and now our museum, YU Museum, is doing an exhibition around my Arch of Titus stuff in the fall that I hope everyone will come to. And so, as I like to describe it, it's Arch of Titus, Inc., but it brought all of YU together with me, whether it be our library with its archives, or whether it be our museum, or whether it be my research assistant, Yaakov Fine, who just walked in the room. We're related. It became not only a family project, but it became a YU family project, and that's been pretty exciting. And let's go through some of it. What I'm going to do is take parts of the book and use those to talk about larger issues. But I've got to tell you that my book has had the oddest experience. When it was reviewed in the New York Times, the woman who reviewed it couldn't understand the content, but she liked my writing. Then there was the Catholic News Service, and guess what they stressed? Everything Catholics find interesting. So when I proved, I think, that the myth of the menorah at the Vatican comes from the 1960s and spread as a result of the Second Vatican Council, they were thrilled with that one. So that found it into their review. Then there was the Jerusalem Post that noticed the political issues involved in the use of the menorah as a Jewish symbol starting in the 19th century and continuing to the present, which you would expect of the Jerusalem Post. Then there was my student who reviewed it in The Commentator. And what did he do? This delightful boy. What did he do? He wrote about it, what it was like to be a student studying all of this. And he didn't know that's what he was writing about, but that's what he was writing about. In other words, what it's like to be with his professor at the Jerusalem show at the Met and have someone come up and ask for an autograph. He thought that was the coolest thing, which I did too, actually. But the kids caught into that part, and that's part of the excitement that my research, I try to bring them into the process and get them involved. And I'll share some examples of that as we move on. And so each of the reviewers, as the book has gone through the system, since it's a Hanukkah book, you know, 'tis the season, and so it's found its way into most of the press, each of the reviewers saw something different, because it's all there. And of course, the foreword, what did they find? Oh, they asked me questions about Christmas trees. Surprise! Right? In other words, each group found something interesting and different that fit its needs, and everything except the Christmas trees is in my menorah book. In fact, the menorah, if you look at the yellow, is a story of memory created and recreated, of a past forgotten and sometimes re-remembered. again and again. In other words, as the oldest symbol in Western civilization, after all, the cross doesn't come up until the 3rd or 4th century, and the crucifix not to the 5th or 6th. The crescent, there's no Islam for a while, right? And so in Western civ, as a religious symbol that has maintained itself for a very long time, this is it. This one goes back to Bezalel ben Uri and continues till then in one form or another. And we're going to deal exactly with the question of the form of what we're talking about. But the truth is, all of this began in 2012 when I took a team to the Arch of Titus, and there we began thinking about what this menorah thing really looks like. Because by that point, everybody knew that Roman art was no longer that white stuff that everyone thought it was, right? Modernism liked white and black, right? That's how priests and then rabbis ended up with black clothes, because they didn't have them in Eastern Europe most of the time. That's how Sikhs ended up with black turbans. I actually sat in a cab once in New York and made friends with a cab driver who had a black turban. And I looked at him and I thought, that's anomalous. So I started asking questions, and he was asking me Jewish questions. And so I said, then why do you have a black turban, knowing they don't do that in India? And he said, oh, I'll tell you. In America, they think that black is a serious color. The priests wear black. The rabbis wear black. So we can't wear our usual white and orange, which are our colors. We had to wear black too. Americanization. But Americanization took a liking to black and white, which is why, as you know, people on the trains into Manhattan and coming in from Long Island or from Westchester wear blue suits, brown suits, black suits, but never chartreuse suits. They're not serious, right? Now, here we are at the Arch of Titus in 2012. It was a big deal, actually, for the archaeologists to let me put up the YU flag. They don't usually let you put up your advertising. And it wasn't even up that long, but it's certainly been projected a lot of times since. I must tell you the excitement of being up there with the menorah. Here you see it, the procession in 71 of the Kalim of the Beit HaMikdash into Rome, a major propaganda effort by a new imperial house after a major Roman series of debacles. They called the year 69 the year of the four emperors. That tells you something about the mess that was going on as Rome was trying to figure out what to do with its imperial power and who to pass it on to. Vespasian won the battle, and then he and his sons used the Jewish war as a vehicle for establishing their power. And so if there is a way to visually or textually use this war, they did it. So one of the things they did was built this Arch of Titus thing on the sacred road of Rome, facing east-west, more or less. And so the light coming through across it makes these people look like they're moving. Now, let me ask a question. Who are these people? Everyone who thinks they're Jews, who've heard somewhere that they're Jews, raise your hand. Anybody? Great. Anybody who thinks they're Romans? Okay. And all those people who don't really have an opinion on this subject, that's everybody else, right? Okay. Now let me tell you that since the Renaissance, Jews have identified these people as Jews. But they are Romans, and they are Romans celebrating with wreaths on their heads and with priests among them the glory of Vespasian and the glory of Rome. Now, Jews starting in the Renaissance said something really amazing. They said, you know, look up there. And it was really dirty then, and they really couldn't see it very well, right? Look up there. They think they destroyed us? No! Those are powerful Jews on the Arch of Titus. And Zionism looked at them and said, those are powerful Jews on the Arch of Titus. And little kids in Israeli schools get tests today where they are told that those are powerful Jews on the Arch of Titus, right? Fifth graders, I know a fifth grader who got the test wrong because her father's a classicist. Okay? In fact, they are Romans celebrating their victory. They're carrying these heavy things. They even have pillows under their shoulders. Why? Because they are carrying these very heavy golden objects, which are literally receding into the stone into Rome. This is the menorah, you know about that one. This is the Shulchan Lechem Apanim, that's just a carrying base. And these are the Chatzrotzrot, okay, which Josephus, the Jewish historian, also calls Chatzrotzrot. In other words, rabbis call them that, Josephus calls them that, life is good. Up above, two horse-drawn chariots, one for Titus and one for Vespasian, with the god of victory in the center. Now, it's all very white, but it wasn't in antiquity. You can see it up close, right? You can see their faces. Joseph Klausner, the Zionist historian, was very unhappy in the late 20s when he came to Rome, and he looked at these Jews and said, they don't look like Jews, right? But he was so sure they were Jews. Now, the funny thing is, when you watch scholars talking about this, Jewish scholars, mostly yeshiva-educated scholars in the 19th century, they write articles in the early Hebrew press, and they say, oh, we're going to Rome, and we're going to see the Jews in the Arch of Titus, and we're so excited. And then by the time they write their dissertations in German, they figured out that they're not Jews 20 years later. And you can watch their process as well. Now, that's what we found. Little drops of yellow. Now, what were we trying to prove? That this panel was painted. Right? And what better object to look at for two reasons than the menorah? Number one, you know what color it's going to be painted, yellow. And number two, once you find the yellow of the menorah, you can make the New York Times and every European newspaper, which we did, with little tiny bits of yellow. Can you imagine that little bit of schmutz right here? And we made the New York Times. Now, up above is Heinrich Piening, our technology person, scanning the cracks of the menorah, going deep into the cracks, looking for little bits of pigment where we could get the values of the colors and then put it into a database and read it. When I explained this for the first time 4 years ago, people looked at me and said, what? Today when I say that, it's like, oh yeah, that's how you do it. And so it shows how technology has changed. Okay. Now, and I'm going to go through some sources from the book to explain this. Here I was up on this scaffolding next to the menorah. You got to get this. I was the kid who learned about the Israel state seal sometime around the beginning of June in 1967, right? It's part of a six-day war. Oh my God, we're going to be destroyed, and then wow. And so I've been dealing with menorot probably most of my career, going back to advanced placement art history where I wrote about biblical interpretation through images of the menorah. And if you go to my books, you'll see a menorah on the cover of almost all of them. It's not for naught that one of the newspaper people said to me, you're the menorah man! Right? So then it became my son Kobe and me, so we're the menorah men. And here I was face to face with the greatest of all Jewish symbols, the menorah of the Arch of Titus. After a few minutes, it became clear to me that my almost mystical ascent up the scaffolding, which I climbed in record time, was far more than a dispassionate trek. Now, lots of people, who's been to the Arch of Titus? Good. Did anybody, when you went there, like Sing HaTikvah or Say Shir HaMalot, I've seen all those things, or then there's the usual phrase, Titus, you're gone, we're still here, I'm Yisrael Chai, right? That's the Jewish ritual of going to the Arch of Titus. It's like those poor kids who get told by their Haredi rabbis to go to the Arch of Titus, to go to the Vatican Museum and ask for the menorah, right? Why? Because of a legend that they heard in Brooklyn. Now, the truth is that Freud went to the Arch of Titus, and he wrote back to a friend of his who was having some difficulties back in Germany, the Jews have survived it, meaning the Arch. In other words, we are not the first ones to make that trek. The Satmar Rebbe, according to Satmar legends, went to the Arch of Titus, was all excited to see the menorah, and then an Italian Jew came out and said, don't you know this is a Zionist symbol? And he got back into his car and drove away. Right? But it shows you how close Satmar really is, and it's telling the same stories, but always with a twist. Right? Chaim Weizmann came, Rav Herzog came. Everybody who goes to Rome goes to see the menorah. That's what you do. And then you say, Titus, you're gone, and we're still here. I'm Yisrael Chai. And then you think you're going to spit, but you don't, and you walk away. Right? That's the relationship with this thing. Now, it is not true that Jews have any kind of custom about not walking under it. It's something that developed in the 19th century, probably after it was reconstructed as an independent arch. Before that point, it was just a way around the city. In other words, if you wanted to get to point A in Rome, to point B in Rome, this was the way to do it. There was no other way to do it. Italian Jewry has no registered minhag to stay away from it, but you can imagine they wouldn't like it so much. This was an awful place. I found myself fidgeting and thinking about the humiliations that my ancestors had felt here, of the rabbis and simple Jews who came to peer up at the menorah from below, of early modern Jews humiliated here by the church. This is a drawing of of one of the popes going through the Arch of Titus, traveling across Rome from the Church of St. John of the Lateran, which is his palace, to the Vatican. And the Jews meeting him there with a Sefer Torah, which he would take out of their hands and say, "I respect this, but not you," and then throw it on the ground. It was really a happy moment. There were these plaques found recently at the Jewish Museum in Rome, where they would greet the Pope with psukim, right, in Hebrew and in Latin. And they chose just the right psukim that, if you read it in Hebrew, it sounds like, and then read it through Chazal, it's a curse. And if you read it in Latin, it sounds like a blessing. So they found a nice way to sort of live with the tensions they had to live with, the same way they claimed that the menorah was being carried by Jews. It was an astonishing feat, I just got to point this out, for this little Italian Jewish community to maintain its dignity in the face of this papal onslaught over generations, which led to, as you know, children being taken out of the ghetto because their fathers converted and taken out of the hands of their mothers. And it was a horrible history. And that they did it is quite astonishing. But remember, these people truly believed that somewhere in Arabia or somewhere else were the 10 lost tribes waiting to invade the Christians. And so they weren't alone. Then 1947 came. This is David Prato. David Prato came to Rome after the previous rabbi during the war, Zulai, converted to Catholicism and hid in the Vatican. Okay? So he came back from Palestine after the war. He'd been the chief rabbi until Mussolini. He came back from Palestine, became the chief rabbi, did a wonderful job of chief rabbi, rebuilding the community, collected the survivors of the Italian Jewish community and all those other survivors who were all around southern Italy in the area of Rome waiting to go to Palestine. One of the groups that was here was the Kibbutz Agudas Yisroel. Right? Don't tell them. Now, here at the Arch of Titus, they gathered in 1947 on the 30th of November, actually on the 1st of December, the day of the vote for the partition plan, the day after the partition plan. And they greeted the Jewish state. Okay? They not only gave speeches, but when I've gone through and introduced some of these people, like this guy sitting right here, he's called Hamitzri, the Egyptian. The Germans found him on a bridge, smiling, and they thought he was being scornful, and they cut out his tongue. Okay? In other words, there's a story behind each and every one of these people, and I walked through the Beit Knesset in Rome with one of our musmachim, who's Italian, and I found the people who knew the people, who remembered the people, who could tell me about each of these individuals and what they were doing there. Now, if you listen to the tapes about this event, or if you read the newspapers, the Jews came to the Arch of Titus, and the Jews marched through it backwards to take the menorah home, right? Because after all, the guys up there are Jews, and the Jews down below are taking the menorah home. It's a majestic moment. There's a film of it. It's really amazing. But when you listen to the oral testimony of this event, of course, the revisionist hated the leftist hated the revisionist said, you know, those leftists, they came and they wanted to sing that damn song, Techazachna, and we came and we sang the song of the Biryonim, right? We all did our thing, but somehow they kept us all quiet because otherwise this wouldn't have worked all in the international press, right? And so there's always the surface and then what's going on underneath it. In doing history of this sort of stuff. Now, these Jews symbolically carried the menorah home, and in 49, the Arch of Titus menorah became the symbol of the renewed state of Israel. Does anybody own one of these medals? Anybody? No? How could that be? It's the most popular Jewish medal ever minted, starting in 1958. It's called Israel Liberata, right? And on this side of the coin, you see a nice Jewish mother holding up her baby, a male planting a tree under the Judean palm tree, and of course, it's a takeoff on the Judea Capta coins created under Vespasian and Titus and his brother Domitian, where the Roman soldier is guarding and Judea cries, right? And so it's really a takeoff, but this pamphlet, which is almost lost, and I found it pretty much by accident, shows the Jewish soldiers, remember, carrying the menorah and almost like Pygmalion turning into Israeli soldiers. That sense of Bayamim Ahem Bazman Hazeh was really central to early Zionist stuff, whether one was a revisionist or whether one was a laborite. This was the shared culture. Now, if you think that this is just an Israeli thing, of course, it found its way to New York City a couple times. The first time in the menorah march that was organized by Nathan Berenbaum in the 60s, which was a march in favor of the freedom of Soviet Jewry, where everyone thought that Berenbaum was a Meshuggah. Everyone thought that Birnbaum was a Meshuggah, but he got the young people, especially the ones who studied in Washington Heights, right, to go down there and march through on the Exodus March and on the Menorah March. And on the Menorah March, they carried the menorah on their shoulders, and thanks to Shuli Berger, who's sitting right there, our archivist, I found those pictures and was able to publish them. But this is a different set, which you can see by Nathan Rappaport, which is on Park Avenue Synagogue. And again, you can see the soldier and the farmer and the kibbutznik carrying the menorah back to Jerusalem. You know, it's the opposite of the Arch of Titus, with the angels above singing. Now, this drawing of it, which is in his archive in Israel, is going to be in the exhibition at YU Museum in the fall. So come visit us. I even empathize with those Jews who today passionately believe a new myth. One that suggests that the menorah is somehow hidden in the bowels of the Vatican. Sorry, it isn't. And even with those dangerous and misguided Jewish nationalists who hope to rebuild the temple and restore the menorah with their own hands. And this was a meme that came out online not so long ago. I like this one. It's like this one, but bigger. Okay. So now we are back at the Arch of Titus. Now, you remember what the psukim say, and you have them in Hebrew on your handout if you'd like to look at the original, right? It's right here. Everyone got one? Okay. Now, you can understand why the Midrash would say that Moshe Rabbeinu got really confused with this object. And you will make a lampstand of pure gold, the base and the shaft and the lampstand will be of hammered work, its cups, its bulbs, its flowers shall be of one piece with it, and there will be six branches. Everybody's read this. I don't have to go through with it. Now, the important part is, make it as I showed it to you on the mountain. And the Midrash has it that Moshe was so frustrated trying to make such a thing based upon this description that he finally threw up his hands and God said, that's what it looks like, and he still couldn't do it. And so Bezalel did it. And so Moshe was so peeved because, Moshe's a human being in the words of Chazal, that he looked at Bezalel and then said, Bezalel, you are hiding Betzel Kel. You are hiding in the shadow of God when he showed me the picture. Or you couldn't have really done that. Right? In other words, we have a very difficult image, and in fact, when I ask students to draw just based upon what's written here, what the original menorah looks like, it comes out like the strangest looking stuff. Because unless you have a mesorah of what a lamp looks like, you don't know what a lamp looks like here. You don't know what those kanim are, whether they're round, whether they're straight. You have no idea unless there's some sort of tradition that tells you what they look like. Okay? And you don't have no idea what a bulb looks like. You have no idea what the base, that's how they translated it, looks like. You just have no idea. You can't figure it out, and the Torah tells you so. And no matter how many words you compulsively add, and by the way, and say it twice, right? Because he did it, we make it, and then he did it. So we compulsively say the same words twice. It doesn't do you any more luck. If you're not visually adept, you're not going to get it. And if you don't live in the middle Bronze Age, you ain't going to understand the original one or any one since. You have to have additional information. Now, during the Second Temple period, everybody knew what the menorah looked like. It was all over the place. Whether it was on these coins of the last of the Maccabees, Matityahu and Antigonos, or whether it's on this recently discovered menorah from a place called Migdal, which is in the Ginosar Valley in the northwest corner of the Kinneret, where it's sitting on a base. Right here, see the base? And it's three legs here, and this one has sort of a solid base. And there's this funny thing on the Arch of Titus. Remember, the Torah doesn't tell you what any kind of base looks like. So what they generally did was take any old lamp of their period and add the branches, whether straight or round or whatever they did. But in the Second Temple period, it was always round. And in fact, Philo and Josephus, two great Jewish thinkers of the first century, both described the branches as representing the lamps on the branches, as representing the visible planets, the sun and the moon, which is based upon Yechezkel's vision for the Haftarah this week, right? And not only that, as Yechezkel has it, the sun and the moon and the stars are looking down on you, right? Because they're flying through the sky at a different orbit than all the other planets, meaning the stars. So the lamps represent the stars in the sky, and the branches represent their trajectories through the sky. Okay? Their round branches represent their trajectories in the sky. So people who lived in the first century, while the Beit HaMikdash existed, read it as a rounded branched object. Now, you remember that, let's go back. You can't tell from this what the branches look like. Okay? But by the first century, they had made the decision that they look like this, right? This is not some sort of attempt to use a Roman arch or some sort of non-Jewish thing. The branches were very standard. The bases were not. There are many different bases on the menorah of the Second Temple period. Some of them look like triangles. Some of them look like three-legged objects, which is a Roman lamp. And one of them looks like this, which has driven rabbis crazy because, as you know, Chazal and the Rambam read the base as a three-legged object. So how is it that this thing on the Arch of Titus isn't a three-legged object? Well, it isn't. And in fact, I can tell you that the gold color of the base and the gold color of the branches is exactly the same. And there is a hole right here, right through this object for carrying it. It is not a carrying piece. It is an intrinsic piece of the artifact. Which means that there are lots of menorahs in the temple. Now, anybody who's ever been on a shul building committee knows how it works. You go to some artisan and say, I want to build X, I want to make X, I want to have this made. You give them all the rules that the halakha require. You say, make this thing, and by the way, I'd like it purple or I'd like it green, right? Lots of people are giving menorahs and other holy objects to the temple. That was not an unusual situation. My guess is that there were a lot of people giving objects to the temple. There were a lot of menorot in the temple. We know that they would switch them on holidays if they became tameh. Somebody made this one. And since there's no description in scripture about what the base looks like, he did this. Now the animals on the base, whether they be eagles or dragons, let me tell you a secret. In the ancient world, dragons were not things that are mythological. They figured they lived somewhere else. And you know why they thought that? Because they found dinosaur bones. And they were reconstructing them. And they were interpreting them. And so if they found a mammoth, if you take a mammoth and put his arms up like this, he looks like a cyclops. And they found great big lizards. And the emperors were collecting them. And so was Herod the Great. So these were real animals. These were not Avodah Zarah animals. Not only that, they thought these animals were so cool, they were painting them all over their houses and all the furniture. So this was about as parv as any kind of imagery could be. Though later generations who didn't know that couldn't know that. Okay? And so it drove them crazy when they saw this object, as we'll see in a minute. Now, this is what menorahs look like in ancient synagogues, right? The branches made to look sort of like pomegranates, because that looks sort of like Keftor Uferach. And Josephus says the branches look like pomegranates. Right? See pomegranates on this one? This is on the floor at Hamat Tiberia. This one's at the Israel Museum from not far away. Notice the base here is a standard Roman lampstand, as we'll see in a minute. Glass cups on top. There were glass cups on top here as well. If anybody watches the YU blog too carefully, you'll know that I talked about this lamp a bit on the YU blog just recently. You can go see it if you haven't. But it was colored. How do I know that it was colored? Because everything Roman was colored. So I sat down with my crayons and took all of my colors off of this mosaic. I used a brown ochre and put it in the back. I put a brown ochre in the front. Then I took this mosaic with the green. I put a little bit of green, right? Then I put the color, a little bit of gold, because ancient texts talk about menorahs having gold and red and green. Then there's a piyut that was found in the Cairo Geniza that describes the menorah as having white flowers and red bulbs and green greenery. And so I did the one on the bottom. And so that no one would think that I believe it, I made my own inscription. It says, Dekirata Shimon Bar Levi, that's me. The Avon with an Aleph instead of an Ayin, because in the ancient world Jews often mistook and wrote an Aleph for the word Avad instead of an Ayin, because they didn't hear the difference. The Avad Hada Menarta, who made this menorah. And in the article where I talked about this, I described these colors, which I did with my own Crayola crayons, doodle A through G. Doodle, right? Now the point is, none of this coloring is correct, but I can tell you that menorahs in the ancient world were not black and white, or just yellow sometimes. And Baruch Shekivanti, this is a manuscript from the 13th century in Ashkenaz, where he had the same midrash that I did. Right? Colored menorahs. And you can go see this at the Metropolitan Museum of Art until the 7th of January. It's in the Jerusalem show, which if you haven't seen it, you got to go see it. Okay? Then there's the base. This is a standard base. This is a standard base for a lampstand. This is a base for a church lamp. It's a standard base because the Torah doesn't tell you what the base should look like. So what do? You make the same furniture that exists in the world in which you live. Right? Now, all this changed with the coming of Christianity. This is a stone from Asia Minor from some Jewish building where the stone got bashed to hell. Right? When some Christian came in and made it holy by adding a cross. But look at this. This is a manuscript by Rashi. It's not by Rashi. It's by Rashi's grandchildren. People you may have heard of. They're called the Balei Tosfot. Right? It's in Oxford right now. It's from 100 years at, or so 150 years after Rashi. But the problem with the Rashi that you have in your local Chumash is it has no drawings. When Rashi says, and this is what it looks like, your Chumash doesn't have a drawing to show you what it looks like, right? So you're left blind without drawings, and none of those fancy people who make fancy Chumashim have had been smart enough to go in and take the Rashi and take the pictures out of the manuscripts and place them right in the middle of the commentary so that you can know what the manuscript that was copied from a manuscript of Rashi's own hand looked like, okay? And that's what it looked like. And you notice a couple of things. Number one, it has round branches. You know, this is a conscious conversation with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It has round branches. Number two, look at the stalk. You see it? The stalk has a rope-like patterning. Okay? You see it? Sort of like a rope. Rashi calls that in his commentary, Nieler, which is niello work. It's a very common technique used in the Middle Ages whereby you would put incisions in metal, fill that incision with enamel, heat the metal, the enamel stays, and hence you end up with lines in the enamel. Okay? Rashi actually drew what niello work looked like. Now, next to it is a lampstand from a church in Essen, from about less than 100 years before Rashi was born. Okay? Notice it looks an awful lot like the one that Rashi made. You know why? Because they live in the same world and they use the same technology and they're reading the same Bible. And sometimes they're even talking to each other, because we know that 100 years later there's a guy who is actually Nicholas of Lyra, who was actually talking to Rashi manuscripts, right? And saying, Rabbi Shlomo says this, and this is what I think. Okay. Then there's the famous one. These were all brought to our attention by a fellow named Yosef Kapach, who, among all of his many accolades as the chief Yemenite rabbi and great scholar of Yemenite tradition and Maimonidean, was our next door neighbor in Jerusalem for 4 years. And so I can tell you from personal experience that I've actually met a tzaddik, and he is it. Now, Rav Kapach took the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah, which he wrote when he was 24, in Arabic, right? And translated it into Hebrew. This is the manuscript, the main manuscript that he used, which is at Oxford University. And in his commentary, Rav Kapach provided a bad picture of this manuscript to the right and said, this is what the Rambam's talking about. Okay? Let's notice a few things about this manuscript before we go any further. Number one, the Rambam, like Moshe Rabbeinu, could not draw for anything. And he tells you, as we're going to see, that he didn't know how to draw. Okay? Not only that, he so can't draw that he missed the lines and went right into his words. Right? When he could have easily lowered it below the baseline of the text into the next line and had lots of space. Next to it is a 14th century manuscript in a private collection in Holon of collected Rambam stuff. There is a small tradition of Rambam manuscripts that copied this directly. And where the Rambam will tell you, if you take a look at my second source, let me see if I can see it, because it's too small, I'm sorry. If you look at my second source, he tells you somewhere around footnote, I can't have enough light, there's no more light over here. He tells you somewhere around, look, this right here, it's a net, or get, whatever it says. Ba'ani etzayelacha ata betzura zog ve'intav nit meshulash v'kaftorim agur v'aperach chetzi agur v'kol zeh kedei lahakel al hatzayar. I'm going to draw this stuff, and I'm going to make coded images for them because I have to make my drawing easier. And then he goes on and says, I don't draw very well. Right? Now, he says he doesn't draw very well, and he's drawn the whole thing in code. And he tells you so. You can read it. And this is Kapach's translation. But his son, Avraham ben HaRambam, says that the Rambam believed that this was the original menorah, and this is the original shape. Okay? Avraham ben HaRambam, his son, who was involved with communal leadership and also Sufi prayer practices, Avraham ben HaRambam claims that the Rambam wasn't just making a schematic picture. He actually meant it. And Yemenites took that seriously in their manuscripts of the Rambam. And the Rambam goes farther, according to Avraham ben HaRambam, and thought every other menorah was wrong. Now, why would he think every other menorah was wrong? Because, again, the Torah doesn't tell you the shape of the menorah, and there is no Masorah in Chazal regarding the shape. In other words, Chazal never tell you the shape. They just know it. It's sort of like knowing that tefillin are round, never, and that tefillin are black all the time, right? In other words, one of those things that everybody knows, except it's not written in the text, and living in a world where one was in constant dialogue with literalists, otherwise known as Karaites, B'nai Mikra, Rambam read the Torah and said, well, it doesn't say it's round, why should it be round? According to Avraham ben HaRambam. According to his own manuscript, however, he made things straight, and he made things, shapes that he didn't really think they were, and code them, because he says straight out, I don't draw very well. So you can take that whichever way you want. I have just laid out the evidence. Now, everything changes with Zionism. In the 1880s, Jews in Eastern Europe saw the menorah for the first time. And in the newspaper Hatzvira, they're very excited that they are seeing the menorah, that they get to see the Arch of Titus, because printing for Jews didn't include photographs until the 1880s. Okay? So the image of this stuff spread like wildfire through the Zionist press. And all of a sudden, Westernizing Jews who wanted nothing more than to be part of the Western world, but somehow to maintain their Jewishness, found a birth certificate at the Arch of Titus. Look, there we are, carrying our menorah. Oh yeah, well, it has that funny base. Rabbis don't like it. Ojutertov. Right? Rabbis don't like it. Oh, what a shame for them, because that's the real one. You can see the pressure that rabbis were under in dealing with this. Right? Because rabbinic tradition was then under siege. Here we have an artifact in Rome that didn't look, have a base that was like what rabbis anticipated. Okay? And so this menorah from 1880 on spread like wildfire. Those of you who are from New York might know that it used to be on the facade of the Jewish Theological Seminary, on the gate as you walked in. It's in St. John the Divine, given by Adolf Oakes. It's everywhere in Palestine. But the most important menorah ever made before the symbol of the state in 1949 was this little old brass hat pin made for the Jewish Legion, the first Jewish army ever, during World War I. Now, the soldiers were very well-known people. The organizers were people who were called Trumpeldor and Jabotinsky, right? One of the young soldiers was a boy named, Ben-Gurion, right? Everybody who was anybody in Palestine was part of this, and there were vast numbers of New Yorkers, Canadians, Englishmen, Jews who joined the Jewish Legion, okay? At the end of the war, after being nudged by Jabotinsky, one of his greatest skills was nudging people. Well, after being nudged by Jabotinsky endlessly, this became the symbol of the Jewish Legion. The first time a menorah had government sanction ever. And so you see the rabbi of the Jewish Legion, of the Duda Ivri, in his soldier suit. He's very cute, isn't he? And then in 49, slowly but surely, looking for kind of a retro image that would swallow up the Beitarniks into standard Zionist imagery, because this became the symbol of Beitar, this image was chosen. The one that we know that was done in 1949. Notice there's no animals in the base. Now, rabbis hated this Arch of Titus thing, especially with those animals down there. But it started not with Rob Herzog, who you see at the Arch, but rather with Moses Mendelssohn. Now, Moses Mendelssohn wrote a book called Sefer Netivot HaShalom, which is a Torah commentary and German translation. Now, people like to read Moses Mendelssohn as some sort of crazy reformer, and we shouldn't like him and all of that, but he was a deep conservative. In other words, today he'd be modern Orthodox. And in fact, that's how he's read in Germany by the modern Orthodox, right? In other words, the Reform claimed him, the Orthodox claimed him, everybody claimed Moses Mendelssohn. He's waiting for someone to write a book on the reception history of Moses Mendelssohn since his death. It hasn't happened. We barely have good studies of Moses Mendelssohn himself. But in the Bior, he has this amazing statement on the Pasuk on page 2. All right? I'm just going to read the English to you because it's here. And know that in the city of Rome, among the ruins that remain from the palaces and castles, there still remains to this day remains of a magnificent building of marble that they erected in honor of Titus and Vespasian, called the Arco di Tito, or if you prefer, the Triumphogen dem Titus. Okay? Recognizable there are the bas-reliefs of the temple vessels. It's the only place he talks about any archaeological anything in the Bior, as far as I could find. The temple vessels that the enemy brought with him from the capture of Jerusalem when he returned from having destroyed the house of our God, and among them the images of the menorah is easily recognizable to this very day. However, it appears from the books in which they copied these images, they cannot be trusted at all. Now, what's he saying? You can't trust the Arch of Titus. Now, here's the picture. Jews in Germany were westernizing at what he considered an alarming rate. That's why he was making a German translation and commentary of the Torah. It was being paid for by the elite of Berlin Jewry, whose children acculturated rather quickly in the next generation. But he's creating this book, and again, he's looking at that Arch of Titus thing, and it doesn't look like what rabbis say. Now, here's his problem. Everyone knows the Arch of Titus. It's all over Germany. Everyone's going on these trips to visit the classical sites. It's a cultured thing to do. All of Germany knows what this looks like, and they're all saying, Jews, that's yours. And the Jews are saying, that's ours. And then in comes Moses Mendelssohn and says, they got it wrong. At stake is the authority of the rabbis. Because if the rabbis got this wrong, what else did they get wrong? Right? You see the problem? So listen to what Moses Mendelssohn had to do. And it's copied in books. Now, this is all based on his commentary on Ur'eh v'aseh. So it's all about Riyah. It's all about sight. Okay? Where am I? They cannot be trusted at all. It is possible that the stone carver had no intention to copy them exactly. In other words, the Roman guy who made it, we can't say Romans are bad. Romans are the equivalent of Germans. Right? We like Germans. We want to be Germans. We want to be accepted by Germans. We want to be emancipated by Germans. We cannot say Germans are bad. Hence, we cannot say that Romans are bad because the Germans see themselves as the continuity of the Germans. Hence, the Kaiser, who is the Tsar, who is the Caesar. Right? So we can't say they're bad. So it must be that the artist just didn't mean to do it exactly. He made it into some goyish thing. Copy them exactly, especially as the building was apparently not constructed until after the death of Titus, which is true. It was a decade later, and I point out that the menorah was in a temple down the street all through this period. Okay, so you can see the original in Rome, and we have texts of rabbis going to see the menorah in Rome in the second century. Okay, it is possible that he did not place the vessels, themselves before his eyes when he carved them, and was not careful to make them appropriately. It is true that they took the vessels from the house of our God to Rome and hid them there for their treasury, as our sages of blessed memory remember, and I give the sources, and there Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yossi, that's after the time of Bar Kokhba, right? Rabbi Yossi is a student of Rabbi Akiva, so it's about 150. Who lived a few years after the destruction, he gets it wrong. The priestly frontispiece that seats and the parochet. Now we have other texts now that say the menorah as well that were found more recently. And the end of the chapter of Avot Rabbi Natan says that the grinding stone of the house of Abtinus was there, and the table and the menorah and the curtain and the frontispiece are still stored in Rome. Now, our friend, Moses Mendelssohn, who doesn't usually get a lot of good play, hates the Arch of Titus for the same reason that Rav Herzog hates the Arch of Titus. Why? Because the base is wrong. Because the base can't be right. It must be that the Romans made it. It can't be the one that was there originally. It just can't be, it can't be, it can't be, because it doesn't agree with Chazal. And a Jewish state that doesn't run on the basis of rabbinic law can't be kosher. And a menorah that symbolizes a Jewish state that doesn't run by rabbinic law can't be kosher. And you can't makshir a state, and its symbol once it's already been established. And so we're at that moment of transformation and construction where he's trying to make sure he gets the symbol the way he wants it, because if he doesn't get it now, he knows he's never going to get it. Right? And so Reshit Tzmichat Ge'ulatenu is endangered by a menorah base for Rav Herzog. Okay? Because if it doesn't line up one for one with Chazal, it can't be okay. Because the state has to line up one for one with Chazal. Then comes the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who is one of those brilliant people of the 20th century, I think, in Jewish life, as an organizer, as a thinker, as, I can't say more, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who in 1982 wrote a sicha where he claimed that Rav Kapach was right, and that the Rambam manuscript is the right manuscript, and that the round branches are the wrong branches, and he does it in ways that fit very nicely with Moses Mendelssohn and with Rav Kapach. We have a long tradition of this. Okay? Rabbis disliking the Arch of Titus menorah and scholars saying, what's the problem? A long tradition of rabbinic dislike and academic ambivalence. Why? Because for academics like me, there's no religious issue here. It's not a religious subject. The question is the dead people we study and what the dead people we study lived with, not what should be in the present, which is always where rabbis have to live. And so the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who had already changed the shape of the Luchot based upon a Mamar Chazal in Baba Batra into those sugar cubes, right, which Jews had used forever as the image of the Ten Commandments. Why? Because if you round the tops, the two tablets look like two tablets. And if you have two square ones and put them next to each other, they look like a domino cube, right? One long skinny thing. And so there was a good visual reason to keep the tops rounded or triangular and not make them the same. And Jews throughout history have done that, even though there was a Gemara that said something different. The Lubavitcher Rebbe jumped on the Rambam manuscript as he was using the Rambam for many, many other purposes and said, this menorah made by the Zionist is the wrong menorah. This is the one that fits a rabbinic authority model. This is the one that fits who we are in the present. And this was the one that's going to be the Lubavitch menorah. Now, the Rebbe already branded the Luchot. He had already branded the tip of the hat. And now he's branding the menorah. And Maya Katz, who teaches the Torah, wrote a wonderful book on the visual culture of Chabad, where she showed that. But what I did was go through the Sichot themselves and his other writings. He wrote a wonderful book called Rishimot Menorah, which he wrote when he was young and was published in the 90s, recently, where he shows his love of the menorah, his interest in the menorah, and ultimately his branding of the menorah. Now, I point out that down below, you see a marvelous rabbi. His name is Gershon Mendel Gorelick. Rabbi Gorelick, you can listen to him. I gave you the URL, I'm just not going to do it now. Rabbi Gorelick is the Chabad Shaliach in Milan, and came out of Russia and came to Chabad late. And he's a legendary leader within the movement. Now, Rabbi Gorelick went with his children a few years ago to the Arch of Titus with a Chabad menorah in hand. And this is what he said, and I thank my friend and colleague Josh Carlick for helping me with the Yiddish, because that's what he spoke. And this is what he said. This is the last page. Kinderlach, Kinderlach! Das ist nicht der Emesse Menorah! Right? The menorah, true menorah, looks like this one. And the menorah that hangs there is a Sheker Gomor! A Sheker Gomor, he says. He says it twice. It is only because it was in the time of destruction and they drove everyone crazy and they murdered millions of Jews. And they could not be, and they could take a falsehood, that is, a false menorah, and say that this is the true menorah. This holding up the menorah is the true menorah. The true menorah never came to Rome. It took hundreds of years, and they, the crazy Gentiles, killed millions of Jews. We hold this menorah, the true menorah, for it was of this kind of menorah that the Rebbe blessed the Hanukkah candles, Benschlicht. Today, no one persecutes us, for now is the end of the final exile. Now, there's a couple of interesting things. Number one, the Rebbe's notion that we are at the end of the final exile, which allows for many different interesting changes. But it was the same case for Zionism as it was for the Rebbe. Zionism was going to end the exile and loosen the bonds and create a new Jewish entity, whether religious or not, or as I'd like to say, Jewishly secular, right? That meant, you'll recall, that a menorah may be kosher because it's Mesechist, but the lulav and the etrog, well, they're treif because they're from shul. That's what constitutes Jewish secular, messianic, right? And so historic Jewish messianism of Zionism saw the menorah as its transitional object, its symbolic object leading to
kind of Zionist national entity, Mashiach Zion. And they took the Ark of Titus in the 1880s and it became Zionist menorah. Responding to that, rabbis didn't like that secularized vision. And in the 1990s, the Lubavitcher Rebbe's followers created their own menorah. Not the one used by the Tzavah and Ali Israel, but the one that's used by Tzivos Hashem. Consciously modeling his youth groups, his symbolism, on the thing that he was trying to take down, which was secularized or even general Jewish culture, in favor of the specific model that was being produced. Now, why did his menorah catch on within some of the firm world? Again, because the Torah doesn't describe the shape of the branches. Okay? That means, since the Torah doesn't describe the shape of the branches, we only know or have evidence of the shape of branches from the first century on, where Jews in writing and in literary sources talked about the shape of the branches. Okay? We do not know what branches looked like in the time of the Torah, and the Torah doesn't tell you. Okay? And that's the whole. In other words, every bit of Jewish history that I have suggested is based upon deep reading of the sources, deep reading of the Mikorot, but not for simply learning, but for keeps. Right? Because how we visualize ourselves tells us a lot about how we see ourselves and what we are. Now, if the Romans hadn't commemorated their victory in the Arch of Titus, says Yehuda Amichai, we wouldn't know the shape of the menorah from the temple. But the shape of the Jews we know, because they begat and begat and begat right up to me. Now, Amichai got it right. Right? We don't, if it hadn't been preserved in various visual forms, we wouldn't know. And in fact, we don't know so much of this ancient history. But the part that we do know, which I've got to say I went through in much too much detail and know much too much about, leads us to some of what I've shared with you today. Now, here we see the second of the menorah men with me at Rome. Just as we were about to leave Rome and go to Israel. And you know what we did? We marched the menorah back to Jerusalem too, just like those Jews in 1947. Now, I know that those aren't Jews on the Arch of Titus, but I do know that by bringing the next generation, whether it be my progeny, or whether it be my bonim, my students, right? All of those fuzzy things that were sitting in this chair the other day, right? Each of them and every one of them, bringing them into the story of the menorah adds depth, and for those who think like Bezalel, a new place to touch the Torah, a new place to think the Torah, a new way to be the Torah, and for those who think like Moshe, a new way to imagine the Torah that they might not have personally considered before. And so all of this is why the life of this project has been the bright life of my classroom now for years at Yeshiva, and as Shuli will tell you, has been something that many parts of our school have been part of for a long, long time. So, in this sense, the history of the menorah is a test case for thinking about the symbols and ideas and institutions and relationships that appear to be timeless, and a challenge to maintain relationships with our root symbols even as our culture reaches toward its inevitable next stages. And speaking of next stages, the colorization process of the Arch of Titus menorah is almost finished, and come spring will appear in the Biblical Archaeology Review and in a program at YU Museum. But that's going to have to wait. Thanks so much.